This is tape number 6, side 1 of the ongoing oral history interview with Professor of English Thomas Schaub, October 23rd, 2006. So Tom, when we last parted, you were working on your PhD and perhaps close to getting it at Iowa.
Yes, the key was really giving those lectures on the crime of Lot 49 and then managing to write that first chapter of the dissertation on Lot 49, which turned out to be a chapter, the way I came to terms with it, and I probably said this before, the way I came to terms with studying Pynchon was to focus on the way in which his novels create a kind of reader. That they really govern the way in which one reads. You're constantly encountering what I called then a kind of strategic ambiguity that refused to resolve in one way or another. And there's a kind of side note to this that I've never written up for some reason or other, and it's odd that I haven't, and the time for writing it up is probably past, but in 1975, I went to the Modern Language Association thinking that, well, first of all, my brother lived out in Berkeley, and I had friends who wanted to go out there and go to the wine country, and I thought in particular I could go there and just sort of check out the MLA because I figured I'd be on the job market the subsequent year. And prior to going out there, my director, Sherm, asked me whether or not any of the names of Pynchon's characters are real names. And I remember saying to him, well, Sherm, I don't think so. I mean, these are comical names that have deep significance, but part of their significance lies in the fact that their names are so cartoonish, so that there's a intentional dimension of the high and the low. On the one hand, the name of the character, like Blodgett Waxwing, or Oedipamas, or Tyrone Slothrop, or Pig Bodine, these are very sort of low culture, comic book, or maybe even army idiomatic kind of vernacular stuff. On the other hand, they have this double side to them that is possibly quite significant. You see this particularly in the name of the character Oedipamas, or Oedipa one more time, or Oedipus one more time, or Oedipamas as in physics, and all kinds of ways in which those names can be read. So they have a kind of endless significance once one inquires into them, even though on the surface they're quite almost silly, even. And Sherm said, well, in any case, why don't you look into it? You never can tell. So I, at some point that fall, went over to the Iowa, University of Iowa Library, and looked through four or five phone books from Los Angeles, Chicago, Miami, New York. There was no Tyrone Slothrop or Oedipamas or Herbert Stencil. And it's pretty comical, aren't they? So
wonderful. I'm enjoying this.
But I got into the habit of it, so that if I traveled somewhere, I'd always ask for the phone book and just look through. And that, I found out that there was a clothing company called Peter Moss, the AAS. And I also I learned that Moss is a typical name in the Netherlands. I learned that Moss in Dutch Afrikaans means tower, for example. Well, at the end of chapter 1 of The Crying of Lot 49, that Bamas is described as a Rapunzel-like figure trapped in the tower of her own identity. So I thought, well, you know, my God, we have one possible meaning here, since Pynchon had read about the Hereros in Southwest Africa, and you know, the Afrikaner, he'd studied this in the New York Public Library, we learned later. And so I thought, well, my God, so he's given his character, you know, she's trapped inside her own name, as it were. And but this is just an inkling of the kind of, oh, I don't know what you would call it, pyrotechnics, kind of combinatory permutations of possibility that Pynchon builds into names, plots, events, dates. It's just an extraordinary imagination at work here. So, to go back to the trip to the MLA, this was one of those long, well, actually a fairly short trip. I think we made it out there in under 45 hours by car, but by changing drivers and just not stopping. Mm-hmm. Might even have been under 40 hours. I think every young man, at least at that time, has gone through that, where you drive coast to coast and you don't stop. You pull over maybe and sleep for an hour. So it was that kind of thing. And they let me off at my brother's house in Berkeley at about 6 in the morning. So I knocked on his door, and David came downstairs, let me in. I don't know that he said anything. It might have been a bit early in the morning, bud, something like that. Anyway, he went back to sleep, and I went into the kitchen and made a pot of coffee. And while the pot was, I was just sort of sitting there waiting for the coffee to be finished brewing, and I saw the Berkeley phone book there. So I pulled the phone book out and looked up a number of names. None of them were there. And then I turned to the S's and looked up Slothrop. And there was Slothrop Tyrone, living on South Bancroft, below Sacramento, in the sort of the, you know, the African-American or black area on the flatlands there, heading toward the bay. Well, this just sent shivers up and down my back, and I began to get a prickle there. And so I had the coffee, and then I, as soon as the public library was open, I went to the Berkeley Public Library, and I asked for the last 10 years of phone books. Well, this caused a bit of a stir. People were looking at me, and so I went back through phone books and found that Tyrone had taken out his service in 1973, which was the year that Gravity's Rainbow was published. And Tyrone is the main character in Gravity's Rainbow. So I took down his phone number and address and went back to the house, my brother's house. And Mom and Dad had shown up for Christmas at that point. And so Mom was there, and I told her that Tyrone was living on South Bancroft. Well, she got very excited about this. She said, well, you have to go down there and knock on the door or something. So you know, she said, do you think this might be Pynchon? And I said, well, it might be, you know. I mean, how do I know? So later that day, I got on my brother's trench coat, because it was a little misty now. So I got on a trench coat and walked down to South Bancroft. It was at 1836 South Bancroft. And I remember going, the house, it was 1834, and then the next house was 1838. And I thought, well, this is just typical. There's no house here. You know, it's just some sort of scam that Pynchon is running here. But there was I walked up the driveway to the toward the garage for 1834. And there was a bungalow in back of 1838. That was 1836. So I walked back to the house and I thought, well, you know, I knew at this point that Pynchon was in seclusion. And I didn't want to blow his cover. I didn't want to, I wanted to somehow make contact with him without being rebuffed or having him learn and then fleeing the scene or something. So I wrote Tyrone a postcard, which was, even that gave me a kind of eerie feeling, to be writing a fictional character, a postcard. So I said, "Dear Tyrone, now that Schlub's out," and Schlub is a figure for Milhouse Nixon in Gravity's Rainbow. It's Richard M. Schlub. Yeah. Who dies of plastic bag asphyxiation. Anyway. So I said, now that Schlub's out, because he'd just been impeached, he just left with his famous double V sign. So now that Schlub's out, what are our silver chances of song? Which was a phrase out of an early part of Gravity's Rainbow. And I signed it, One of the Preterite, and gave him my brother's phone number. Well, I sent it off that day. And then we didn't hear anything. By we, I mean my mother and I. She was on pins and needles. And I'd sort of thought, well, I don't know, I'll go down there and knock on the door and after Christmas. So for Christmas lunch, we're all seated at the dining table. My brother and his wife, my mother and I, and father are sitting there at the table. And Mom is closest to the phone, and the phone rings. On Christmas Day, yes. So she picks it up, and she says, well, yes, just a moment. And she put her hand over the mouthpiece of the phone, and she said to me in this loud whisper, "It's him." So I broke out in a sweat. Mild perspiration.
Yeah.
And so I took the phone, and I was acutely conscious of the fact that I might be talking to Thomas Pynchon. And I wanted somehow to show him that I was worthy of being talked to. Mm-hmm. So I said, "Hello?" That's the best I could do. And he said, and these are exact quotes, because I'll never forget that phone call. He said, "How many times have you read it?" And I said, "Four." And he said, "It's a great song, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes." I didn't say, well, I hadn't thought of it that way. I just said, "Yes, it is." And then he said, "Do you play bridge?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Why don't you come over this afternoon about 2:00 and we'll play a few hands?" And I said, "I'll be there." So, you know, what was I to think? So later that day, I walked down there, knocked on 1836, or maybe it was 836. I remember it was 836. And I think it was 836. But in any case, sounds of four or five bolts being turned, dead bolts. And then he invited me in to this little, I could see from the room that he let me into, through a small kitchen, past this little porch attached to the kitchen, where there were two women in the backyard conducting a funeral ceremony for a dead cat. And they were chanting something or other, and Tyrone said, well, they're burying their cat. They'll be back in a moment, and then we can play bridge. The room itself was the living room. This was a very small Berkeley bungalow that had a kitchen, bath, tiny little bathroom. The living room, about the size of this office maybe, and a bedroom. So probably the footprint couldn't have been more than maybe 16 by 16 or 18 or 20 by 16, something like that. And in the living room was a king-size bed. There were no chairs that I recall. There was a bookshelf in the corner nearest the door. Excuse me. And the bed had black sheets on it. And I noticed that the windows, I had noticed this from the outside, the windows were all entirely boarded up. And the windows were hung with black sheets. So once you were inside, there were black sheets everywhere, black sheet on the bed. And Slothrop was up, kind of a tall, or young-looking guy. He looked kind of like a drug dealer or a hippie of some sort. And I thought to myself, well, this can't be Pynchon, because 49, Lot 49, had already gone through a number of reprintings, and Gravity's Rainbow had made the bestseller list. It had sold over 100,000 copies. Though one of the reviewers, or it might have been Richard Poirier, who wrote that he thought Gravity's Rainbow was probably the most unread top 10 seller book in the country. Couldn't imagine that 100,000 people had read Gravity's Rainbow from beginning to end. I mean, many of my colleagues confessed to reading 50 or 100 pages and they give up on it. Mm-hmm. So the women did presently come back into the living room, and we got two decks of cards out and started playing bridge. And I had Slothrop and I were partners, and the two women played against us. And so, you know, as this is going on, I'm asking him questions about the book. And I ask him questions about the book that I've researched and I know the answers to. Well, so does he. And then I asked him some questions that I didn't know the answer to. I was trying to track down what the Philadelphia Rag was and some other dances that are mentioned in a session where Tyrone is under sodium pentothal. You know, the license plate on the car out front was from Massachusetts, and Tyrone Slothrop is from Massachusetts. And although Pynchon himself is from Oyster Bay, Long Island. So, in any case, every now and then I'll ask him a question, and he answers it. And he's an aggressive bidder, and knew where all the cards were. I mean, he paid attention to what cards were played and mm-hmm. counted his cards and all that. And at one point he said to me, you don't think I'm Thomas Pynchon, do you? And I said, well, I said, how would I know? Because there were no pictures at that time. And he said, well, I guess you wouldn't, would you? And then we just continued to play, and then some other people came over, and there was there was a pot deal. I think at some point somebody was sniffing ether. And at that point I decided that I'd gotten what I was going to get. I'd had the experience that I'd had as much of this as I wanted to have, really. Mm-hmm. That's when I smelled the ether that I thought, well, I think it's time to leave. And there's an interesting two addenda to this story. A couple of years later, after I'd gotten my PhD, I was in Maine, living in Maine in a little town on the coast. And I got a postcard from a guy named Robert Gillespie. And he said, the postcard said, I lived with Thomas Pynchon at Cornell University. Do you want to meet? Signed Robert Gillespie, or maybe it was RG, or I don't know. He said, I'm at the you-know-who's pub in Waterville, Maine every day at 4 o'clock, every weekday. So very soon thereafter, when I had the opportunity, I found the you-know-who's pub and located Gillespie in there, and he was seated with a couple of other faculty members. He was I think he taught poetry at Colby College. And I told him this story. And he said, well, I think you played bridge with Thomas Pynchon. And I said, what makes you so sure? He said, when I lived with Pynchon had bought a house in Utica and rented it out to other students. And Pynchon had lived in one of the rooms. And Pynchon had a king-size bed in their room, and he had it covered in black sheets. And he liked to sit up there like a Buddha and have parties, and people would come over, and he would sit there on this bed and sort of hold forth or take questions. I think he said he even had black sheets over the windows, though that's gotten a little foggy now. But he said, I'm going to call him up right now. So he went to the payphone and dialed information for Berkeley, California. And the operator told him that the phone had been disconnected. This is like maybe, say, 76, probably, 77, and yeah, probably the fall of 77, so it was 2 years later. This is interesting. Yes, and then the other addendum was in 78, I got a contract from the University of Illinois to publish my Pynchon book. And so I went back on the market, and the MLA that year was, 5 years later, was again in San Francisco. And so I remember I was in the, not the Mark Hopkins, it's right there on Union Square.
St. Francis.
The St. Francis Hotel. And I had one last interview. I had 8 interviews that year because of the book. And I had one interview to go, and that's the interview at Berkeley that I ended up getting the job from. But I had some time to kill, and so I said, I wonder, I think I'll go look at the San Francisco phone book. So I went around into the phone lobby area and got out the phone book. And I'll be darned if Tyrone Slothrop wasn't living on Shipley Avenue in San Francisco. Well, this just tickled me no end, and I thought, well, I have to call. Because, you know, Slothrop, I don't know whether you know about Tyrone Slothrop, but he's an interesting character in a number of ways. But perhaps most interesting, narratively, is that he disappears from the novel about three-quarters of the way through. And he doesn't just disappear. He dissolves. He fragments. He's kind of like kind of an Orpheus figure who is just, he loses his sense of his own identity. He's beginning to lose touch. And it's anybody's shot whether or not he, this is a moment of being sort of torn apart by the furies, or whether this is a moment of transcendence. It's been interpreted either way. But in any case, after page 626, Slothrop is gone. He's in northern Germany at a crossroads and crying. So I got change and went back to the phone booth and called the number. And a woman's voice answered, and I said, "Is Tyrone there?" And she said, "Who wants to know?" And I said, "Well, I played bridge with Tyrone about 5 years ago when he was living on Bancroft." And she said, "Oh, we haven't seen Tyrone since northern Germany in the woods," and hung up. Isn't that a wild story?
This is a wonderful story.
Yeah.
Have you ever written this?
I've never written it up. And I don't know why. I've told it probably 50 times or 25 times, and the people associated with the Pynchon Journal want me to write it up for them, and I just never have.
Too private?
Maybe. I don't know. It's back there at the sort of the foundation of that pivot between being a PhD gumshoe and being a professional scholar, you know. I mean, that was kind of a lark, that whole thing. And I don't know.
Pynchon's never spoken publicly, I take it.
He did speak publicly on Homer Simpson one night, I think a couple of years ago. It was his voice, but the character who was supposed to be Pynchon had a paper bag over his head.
So Pynchon has never spoken or lectured or
Ooh.
Appeared on campus? Or
no.
Nothing?
No. So I got my PhD. I finished up and defended in September of 1976. I was given visiting assistant professor or something. So I taught at Iowa in the springtime, spring 77. I had had one interview that that winter with SUNY Binghamton in, yeah, I think it was in New York. But, you know, my heart wasn't in it. I was a bit flipped with them. They asked me questions like, well, does John Barth have 18th century predecessors in the novel? It just seems such a silly question that, yes, he does, you know. But I guess maybe I just wasn't ready for, didn't know what I wanted to do quite, but in the spring of 77,
this concludes side one of tape six. This is side two, tape six, Tom Shaw.
So that spring, I taught two courses for the department and worked part-time with my friends who were in the construction business. And most, I think most citizens have no idea of the pleasure of those first few months after you have your PhD. Because if you have a job teaching, it doesn't start until the following September or August. And if you don't have a job, you at least have the PhD, you've finished that, nobody can take it away from you, mm-hmm. as Jake Barnes says about Robert Cohn's having slept with Lady Ashley. And it's just, you know, it's a really wonderful time. And I, because I didn't get a job out of that interview with SUNY Binghamton, and in my own self-defense, 76 was, if you look at the job availability graph that the MLA puts out, 76 was the absolute nadir of job recruitment. But my friend Peter in Maine encouraged me to come out for the summer and help him put an addition on his on his house. Well, that sounded like a lot of fun to me, so I did that. And then in the fall, I had meanwhile, this is sort of typical of me, while I was finishing up in the fall and spring, I had applied to law schools. And I'd gotten into Iowa City's law school and thought, well, I'll be back in Iowa City. But Peter said to me, if you'd like, you can stay in my fishing cabin down by the lake for a year, and I won't charge you anything. If you will enlarge it and, you know, construct a 10x12 addition to the fishing cabin and make it habitable, you know, year round. So the choice was between staying in Maine and basically just continuing my carpentry work and or going to law school. And, you know, you'd think it was an obvious choice, but I really had kind of gotten that. I mean, there's a romantic element to me that the idea of spending a year in the woods really appealed to me. And I had read some of the introductory materials that the law school had sent me, and that sounded really intellectually interesting, too. But the idea of 3 years of school didn't really. So this was the second opportunity I had to go to law school. I guess we can say that I just didn't want to go to law school. Mm-hmm. And I went to Maine instead. And I don't know that there's much to say about my time there other than that those were years of maturation for me. Those were years in which I applied for and got a job as a grant writer, and then as a program assistant and grant writer for a family planning outfit in Ellsworth. So the way I thought about it at the time was that I was no longer in this world of academia. I was no longer trying to, jump. It just felt like I'd spent quite a few years jumping through hoops. And this last hoop was go to MLA for 5 or 6 years in a row and humiliate yourself, trying to say the right words to get a job. Mm-hmm. And I really liked sort of the life that I had made for myself. And I bought 5 acres while I was up there and built my own little cabin and so forth. So everything was hunky-dory, except that I really didn't have anything to do that challenged me. I felt like the work that I did for the family planning clinic was valuable. I was really sort of pleased to be associated with the distribution of health care to impoverished mothers and children in rural Maine, which is what it was, what they were doing. But I continued to read, and I had plenty of spare time, and so it was during those years, and I wouldn't have done this if I'd gone to law school. I wouldn't have had the time, but during those years, first couple of years, really, I rewrote my dissertation into a book. Oh. And sent it off to Illinois, University of Illinois Press, and in January of 1978, they accepted it. It's just really very exciting moment.
Were you surprised? Had you sent it as a long shot?
I guess I was surprised. There were a number of people who were well-established professors, people like Edward Mendelsohn, who's now at Columbia, and Kacik Talolian at Wesleyan, who had read several of my chapters. I'd gotten to know them by corresponding with them. And they said it ought to be published. They thought of me as one of the people who really understood Pynchon and what he was up to. And they encouraged me to go back and apply for jobs. And they ended up, I wasn't aware of this, but they ended up being the readers for my book manuscript. Oh. And they were very favorable about it and asked for a few changes. But so then I knew I probably had a pretty good chance of getting a job. And so I went back onto the market hoping to get a job in at the University of Maine, Orno, or Portland, mm-hmm. or at Colby. I wanted to stay in Maine. That's where I was. That was my home. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it was the home that I had made, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd be darned if I did not get any interest from any but the most prestigious schools. I got interviewed by Colgate, by Notre Dame, by Carleton, your school, by Davis. I had 8, I can't remember all the schools, but in any case, the last interview I had was with UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And, I think it was, I think it was significant that I really didn't want to go back to academia, that I gave good interviews that year. I was my own person. I had a job. I had a developing interest in healthcare delivery in the state of Maine, and I had raised money. I had talked to the top cabinet people in the state, one of whom went on to become governor. Now, Maine was a very cool place in that way because it was so small. You really could. In any case, to tell you the truth, I wasn't very interested in any, I wasn't interested by any of the faculty that I met, except for Colgate. There was an Emerson scholar, a guy that had written a book on Emerson and Carlyle, and another man there, just two people. But the Berkeley interview was really interesting. And there were, must have been 15 people in the room.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that typical?
It turns out that is fairly typical of the UC schools.
Oh, I see.
They show up with a whole battery of the department. And I can see a reason for that. Here we usually have anywhere from 4 to 8 people in the room. And that's a good thing to have. You know, Stephen Greenblatt was there, and Tom Parkinson, and what's her name? Catherine, in any case, she asked a really great question. She said, are we really supposed to take Pynchon seriously? With all those stupid names and things. Well, this was like throwing a softball to Ted Williams, you know. Well, I shouldn't be so immodest, but
it was
right down my wheelhouse, you know. These were things I thought long and hard about. They were interested in my time in divinity school, and I just found the intellectual exchange among us to be. They made me want to hope to get the job. The other interviews, I thought, well, you know, if I end up going back to Maine, that's fine. But I got kind of interested in this. And then I think Parkinson had me over to the university the next day and showed me around, introduced me to Stephen Greenblatt. I remember he was working on this new historicist thing that he was developing, along with several other faculty at Berkeley. So I ended up getting the job and went there in the fall of, I guess it was 1981. I think that's right.
As an instructor or an assistant?
As an assistant professor.
Assistant professor.
Yeah. And the high point.
1980, Tom.
Oh, 1980. Say. Okay. So the MLA must have been 79. Yeah, that makes sense. So I don't know that there's much to say about, I mean, there's a lot to say about my years at Cal, the way they refer to it out there.
Oh.
It's Cal. The high point really, I mean, the most significant thing that happened during those 5 or 6 years was that I began to learn how to teach and to accommodate my personality to teaching. The students, I don't know whether other faculty would agree with this or not, but I find students are much less harsh judges of their teachers than the teachers are of themselves. And I was always, students at Cal always liked taking my classes. And because they hadn't had any contemporary literature in quite a while. So they were delighted to have courses being offered in contemporary literature. And I ended up teaching one of the large courses that they offered that was in contemporary literature. So I would offer small classes in the Romantics or in contemporary American fiction. But there was also a large lecture that I remember teaching at in one of the large auditoriums. It seemed like you could put a 747 in there. Must have had 250 students in there. And so I learned how to run small classes, run discussion, and I learned how to lecture and hold the attention of students for 50 minutes or 75 minutes.
How do you do that?
Well, I went to a teaching seminar that was held, or a workshop, I should say, at Berkeley by a guy who just won a campus teaching prize. And he said, you have to think of yourself as a cartoonist. You have to think of yourself as addressing three or four points, or maybe 2 points, and just continue to unravel that point. You don't want to just hit them with a battery of information or a sequence of ideas. What you want them to do is to try to get them immersed in, say, one idea in all its complexity and ramifications. And I worked on that. And all the time I was also working on myself, because I had the not uncommon anxiety about speaking in front of people. Mm-hmm. But it became something that I looked forward to doing, even though I remained rather keyed up and excited about these lectures. Mm-hmm. But the students were with me out there. It was really a wonderful atmosphere. I had lines outside my door during office hours. Mm. Students came up to me afterward. I mean, they're genuinely interested in contemporary fiction. I gave a couple of talks at local coffee shops and wrote book reviews for the San Francisco Chronicle. And it was a whole scene out there that was really interesting. In all of the bookstores, you know, go to Moe's and I'm going to say Pelican again, but it wasn't Pelican. What is it? Black Oak Books opened up. I just went through these bookstores combing contemporary literature off the shelves and sometimes getting a steal on a first edition of Barth. Mm. I have a first edition of Snow White by Donald Barth, and I got that for $7. And somebody was not watching what mm-hmm. they were doing. Meanwhile, the Pynchon book comes out, and I'm working on another book about... it begins as a book about contemporary literature from about 1968 on. Mm-hmm. But I began to be interested in what I saw as a kind of, and eventually understood as, the 60s moment is emerging out of a rejection of the old left. And so I went back and began reading in the library journals, fiction, interviews, Partisan Review, Hudson Review, Kenyon Review, you know, all those quarterlies and mm-hmm. reviews, Lifetime, and I began to get a sense of the impact of the political culture on the literary and intellectual culture of late 40s to the early 60s. And I began to write chapters about that. And that ended up becoming my second book, American Fiction in the Cold War. Mm-hmm. This might be the time to say that one of the reviewers for my Pynchon book really saw what I was up to, because I think I mentioned this on an earlier tape. He says that this book really teaches us how to read Pynchon.
Yeah.
That all of the Pynchon scholarship that had come out before had really taken a very thematic approach to Pynchon. The scholars had been busy tracking down allusions and learning the equation was for noise in an information system. All these references and contexts for Pynchon's knowledge that are, you know, that you want to know about. Mm-hmm. And a natural response as a reader, if you're curious about it, is to try to find out about the Philadelphia Reg, or about information and entropy, and about the Poisson equation, and yaw and roll, and the whole history of the missile launch in Germany, and how, you know, you find out that there was a whole body of work that was written in the 40s and 50s about the generals who found out about these amateurs rocketers who were going into these open fields near Berlin and testing rockets. One of whom was Wernher von Braun.
Really?
Yes. And the German, I think it might have been a guy named Kammler? I've forgotten a lot of this now, naturally, but the army found out about it, and there was nothing in the Versailles Treaty against Germany arming itself with rockets or missiles, because there wasn't such a thing in 1923.
Right.
And they were ignoring the Versailles Treaty anyway, but I think as early as the late 20s, they came to them and said, "We will give you funding if you will help us develop an intercontinental missile that we can use to strike England, Netherlands, Paris." Well, they bought into this. Von Braun and his fellow scientists bought into this because their dream was to go to the moon. And, of course, von Braun finally made it.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose von Braun. And anyway, there was a literature about this. Operation Overhead or Operation Crossbow. There were books about this that Pynchon had read. And so a lot of the scholarship was digging this stuff out. Finding out all the stuff about the South Sudvest Hereros in Africa that make up the Mondoggin chapter in V, and Mondoggin's appearance with this Southwest African in the Schwarzkommando that were brought into Germany. So there's all this scholarship, and I think it's important stuff, and I did a lot of it myself. But as I rewrote the dissertation, I began to really see what I had focused on in Lot 49, which is the construction of a kind of unstable point of view, a kind of reading experience, was really the axis of what I had to say about Pynchon. And I wish Illinois had let me say, I probably could have insisted on it, but I wish I had said that the title of the book would be Reading Pynchon. But the first, one of the major reviews of the book said, you know, he's teaching us how to read Pynchon. And that's the way I've been introduced now and then. When I gave the, when I gave a keynote speech at the International Pynchon Conference in Köln, in Germany, several years ago, I was introduced as the guy that taught us how to, taught us all how to read Pynchon. I was very flattered, of course.
Yeah.
There's a lot of...
That's an extraordinary... what's the...
Sobriquet? Yes. Yeah, the guy that did the review for me compared me to, I think it's Stuart Gilbert. Stuart Gilbert's Ulysses, but...
Really?
Yeah, but that's... That's, there's an analogy to be made, to be sure, but it's nowhere as, in my view, Bradley's Rainbow and Ulysses are entirely different books.
But significant to be recognized as the interpreter.
Yes, yes. So, and I'm happy to let that lie, you know, let that sit. And I think it's true that I was the first one to really call attention to the style and the engagement with the reader as being uppermost in what if Pynchon has, if Pynchon's works exert some kind of influence in the world, it's because of the way in which they engage the reader in a kind of consciousness raising, really.
Mm-hmm.
Pynchon offers, in all of his books, he offers an alternative history. And so his work, or even an underground history.
That makes me want to read it, Tom, more than anything else you said.
Yeah. And so he's writing at the same time, you see, that the feminists are beginning to offer histories from women's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that African Americans are rewriting history.
Mm-hmm.
And histories from their point of view. And you get books like Ishmael Reed's Mumbo Jumbo,
mm-hmm.
Which takes an entirely irreverent and sort of subterranean look at American politics and culture,
mm-hmm.
or Flight to Canada. So I think Pynchon belongs in this moment in American culture when the center, the WASP center, is being displaced or problematized, which is a word that was used 20 years ago. And so, in my own way, I spotted what he's doing there, aesthetically as well as thematically.
Mm-hmm.
But thematically, you know, it wouldn't matter if it weren't for the fact that it's written in the way that it is. So I was working on the Cold War book, became American Fiction in the Cold War, and I began to see that I knew really from the get-go that there were, I don't know how many, but a good number of faculty members who couldn't see the interest or worth of Thomas Pynchon, or even of Ralph Ellison.
Really?
Yeah. In my third year review out there, one of the opinions that the chair shared with me was that, well, he writes beautifully, and this is really interesting what he has to say, but why is he working on such a second-rate author as Ralph Ellison? And I remember Tom Parkinson saying to me, you know, the novel, Tom, the novel is not really literature. Parkinson was a American poetry guy.
So, really?
Yes.
At Berkeley?
Yes, absolutely.
Tom, I'm astounded.
Well, I think people, it is, I think, not well
literature.
Known. Now, of course, I can't comment upon, you know, what it's like today, and that wasn't the you know, that was a uniform opinion. I mean, Catherine Porter certainly thought that, and Eric Sundquist certainly thought that Faulkner was literature.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a grave suspicion on the part of the older group, let's say, the more elderly members of the full professors, toward contemporary literature, which is why there hadn't been any taught since. And I think Alex Swerdling taught a contemporary literature lecture course that I ended up teaching for the time that I was there. But there weren't any, you know, wasn't any real regard given to work after World War II.
This concludes side two of tape six. This is tape number seven, side one, Tom Schaub.
So, I was geared, sort of prepared for a negative review in my tenure year. And even though I had a book out, and I was halfway through another book, and I had the, you know, the Ellison thing was appearing in a collection by Robert O'Mealy, and I don't know, I had half dozen articles and reviews, and the teaching was much appreciated by the students. I got stellar teaching reviews, and then in that year of my up and out year, I was awarded an NEH year-long fellowship.
Wow.
To finish the second book. And so I went on the market. And a number of faculty do this. It's not unheard of. But I went on the market and turned up this job at Wisconsin. Was interviewed by Joe Wiesenfarth, who was chair at that time. And Jay Clayton and Phil Herring, and I think Betsy Drain might have been in the room, and a few other faculty members. I was struck by how familiar these people were with contemporary literature, particularly Jay Clayton, who's since left, but Phil Herring and Betsy. Clayton and Betsy Drain both were editors of contemporary literature, associate editors. And I knew that contemporary literature was here because I'd used it as a resource ever since, you know, Cornell College. And so they offered me the job, and Berkeley, the English department, gave me a negative vote, and I appealed this vote, and the department was overturned at the upper levels, whatever that was, you know, the graduate division or the dean or what have you. And I called Joe and I said, you know, the vote has been overturned, and I've been tenured here at Berkeley.
And Joe, they overturned. They didn't just send it back. They gave you tenure.
Yes. And there was some kind of rider on it that the department could. Yeah, it couldn't have been. It must have been. They overturned the vote and said the department could bring me up again, I think, in 2 or 3 years. No, I'm missing a step. They overturned the vote and gave me tenure. And then I called Joe and I said, you know, I told him what had happened. And he said, but of course you're still coming to Wisconsin. And I said, well, you know, I don't know. My family's out here and my wife's family's here. And I said, from my contact with you and the other faculty at Wisconsin, I think Madison might be, I might have more colleagues here that I can talk with about contemporary literature. It might be a better place for me. And Joe said, well, absolutely.
Really?
And yeah, and I said, of course, I hate to go back in my word to you that I was coming. Well, what happened next was that the English department was irritated, even though the department had been very split over me. When it came to whether or not the department had the right to determine its own makeup, then there was, they appealed this decision to the, must have appealed it to the chancellor, because eventually he called me up, it was David somebody at the time, and he said, well, what if I decide in your favor decide to grant you tenure. Will you stay or will you go to Wisconsin? And at that point I thought, why in the world would I stay among these people? Mm-hmm. They don't even think Ralph Ellison, or a sufficient number of them don't think Ralph Ellison is worth studying. Mm-hmm. I'm already on my way toward a second book, and I've got this NEH fellowship that many of them apply for year after year and don't get, and I said, why not go to Wisconsin? And so I said, no, I tell you, if you decide in my behalf, I'll go to Wisconsin and keep my position here at Berkeley and see what I think a year from now. And he said, well, that makes sense. And then we packed up and I drove to Madison that summer and started playing tennis with Susan Friedman and made friends here immediately and I found the intellectual vitality of this department to be far superior to what I had experienced at Berkeley. Now, it may be that I didn't experience that because on the one hand, I wasn't doing kind of antiquarian work of the sort that many of them did. Charles Muscatine out there, for example, I think he was in medieval studies. I mean, they had a really powerhouse department in Renaissance and earlier. And they had become known during those years with Greenblatt and Walter Michaels and a guy in political science whose name I'm forgetting, Paul Alper's wife Svetlana in art history. They started this new thing called the New Historicism. And they started a journal called Representation. And it really was tremendously transformative. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't involved in that. I got there after that circle was formed, and I was preoccupied with developing my teaching chops and getting my second book going. And mm-hmm. Other people there said to me that they weren't included in this initiative either. And things might have, you know, I came here and, you know, they had the draft group here. Eric Rothstein had started the draft group. And so you could, you know, here were faculty showing each other's work, talking about the theoretical foundations and assumptions they were working with. I got invited to teach literary theory and taught sections on Marx and Foucault and the new historicism, and just tremendously interesting to me.
So Wisconsin was a much better intellectual fit for you?
It was. It was. Mm-hmm. No question. And I came here with tenure.
Oh, that's nice.
I made it clear from the beginning that I was not interested in jumping through that hoop again. That if a book, a second book on the way in another year or two, national stature with the NEH Foundation, if this was not enough, I had other things I could do with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always kind of maintained that attitude, though by now I suppose I have to give it up and admit that I'm a scholar, an intellectual, and teacher. But I could have been many things, I think, and been just as happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't about to go through this nonsense again. And this department, happily for me, took me in. And I mean, they were just delighted. I got calls from Howard Weinbrot and Susan Friedman and a number of faculty saying how pleased they were that I decided to come to Wisconsin. And so it was very nice.
Uh-huh.
It's very nice. Now these things are usually engineered. I'm sure Joe said to people, Tom's on the fence here. Give him a call. Tell him how much you want him to come, that kind of thing. Because we do that as part of our recruiting. I know that now. Yes, there's something that's... this department is not very neurotic. People are hard workers here. They do their work. I think it's one of the finest departments in the country. We have two members with essays in PMLA just this month.
Hmm.
We have members that serve on the executive committee and so on. So I didn't think I lost anything intellectually by coming here.
Was English at Wisconsin in one of the top 10 departments or top 20?
It was in the top 20.
Top 20.
And it's hard, I think, for us to break below 10.
Mm-hmm.
When I became chair, I was I attended the yearly meetings of the the Big Ten schools plus the University of Chicago and I guess Northwestern is part of the Big Ten. Yes. And now and then we would talk about how difficult it was to break into the top 10, because almost reflexively people will put down, well, let's see, Harvard, Yale, Virginia, Berkeley, UCLA, Stanford. You know, pretty soon you've got 10 names.
Mm-hmm.
I think Michigan is at some point has been as low as 11 or 12 or 13 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in the last 10, 15 years that I've been here, we've gotten down to around 16. Something like that,
mm-hmm.
16, 17, depending upon the kind of measures. The graduate program is ranked very high. 20th century literature, feminism and women's studies, the Renaissance, what else would be? Well, we get credit for African American literature too, and we mm-hmm. score very high in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
So
you came, Tom, you were here teaching in the fall of 86 or 87?
Well, I came here in 86 with the NEH and spent that year pretty much entirely on my book and reading. I you know, you have to read before you can write. Plus, I got terribly interested in the background of Foucault, into the people that Foucault was influenced by. So I ended up going backwards through Heidegger and Nietzsche, and back to Hegel and Kant and Marx. And so it's great, you know, when you're on leave and you don't have anything to do the next morning, any place do you have to be? If you wake up at 3 in the morning, which I often will do, go into my office and I'd read for 4 hours, and I'd read Lukács or Marx or Engels. Or, so it had a tremendous impact, really, on the tail end of my book, and I kind of rewrote the whole book from a new sort of theoretical foundation. Mm-hmm. And that came out in 91. I think at that point, when it was accepted, Joe put me up for full professor. And then 91, I went to teach in the Giessen, University in Giessen, Justus Liebig Universität in Giessen, Germany, for I think it's 6 weeks. Primarily, I think it's a kind of American studies department. And so, you know, Bonnie and Jessica and I went over there. And then when I came back, Joe urged me to run for chair, to be chair the next year.
So, you'd only been here about 6 years then.
That's right.
Put up for chair. That's kind of unusual, isn't it?
Well,
you must have taken. You must have been. You must have been quite a force early on here, Tom, to be up for chair in 6 years.
Well, I don't know whether I was a force. I think a number of things. I think a number of things positioned me. Or brought my name into the minds of some people. One was that Eric Rothstein, who was the chair immediately before me, undertook a revision of the undergraduate curriculum. And I volunteered to chair that committee. And that was, you know, that was 89. I'd only been a teacher on the faculty for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And 87, 88, a year and a half, and I had ideas about the undergraduate curriculum, both administrative and content-wise, and I worked with Sherry Reams, who was really, Sherry Reams is, she has got a tremendous mind.
Who is that?
Sherry Reams, she teaches medieval literature here in the department, and she was on that committee. It was very good, and I think Charles Reed was on the committee. Anyway, there were a number of good people on the committee that helped move things along rapidly. There were student representatives, and Carol Tarr was the advisor, major's advisor at that time, so she was on the committee, and we got it done in 1 year. We got it done and voted on and accepted in 1 year. And I, during that period, I had a number of occasions to stand before the departmental committee and explain what we were up to, take questions, show them drafts of what we were doing. And so people saw, well, I gather people did. I mean, I have heard people say that's what did it, was that people saw that you could be an administrator, that you had some abilities in that regard. And then there was, there was something else that, I thought there were two things, but in any case, that was something that really, you know, where I had to stand up in front of people and explain things and shepherd something through. And that I got it done in a year and had it ready for the catalog in the fall and all that.
And Tom, what were you trying to do with the undergraduate curriculum? Was that just for the English department?
Yes, it was just the English department.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the undergraduate major, I should say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, let's be clear. It was the undergraduate English major. And I thought it was conceptually weak.
Really?
Yeah, I just thought it was that the students didn't have enough electives, that we weren't clear enough among ourselves what we thought was the most important things that the students should know, that it should have a kind of, I wanted to take a Baroque curriculum and turn it into a modernist curriculum. I wanted, the international style. I wanted the Corbusier. I wanted things to be clean. I wanted a kind of shaker. Let's change metaphors. I wanted it more like a shaker furniture, piece of furniture, than a Baroque piece of furniture.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted it more easily understood by faculty and by students. What are the requirements? They shouldn't be, they should be fairly straightforward, easily understood, and then instead of requiring this class or that class, we should require courses before 1800 and Shakespeare, plus Shakespeare, courses after 1800. American was not getting the attention that it deserved. It was a very Anglophile curriculum. In my opinion, of course, since I was an Americanist. But so we came up with something, and there were people there from linguistics as well as, we didn't have a composition program at that time, amazingly enough. So there was linguistics, and creative writing was represented. Carol Tarr was student advisor, and then we got this through, and I thought that we ought to have topics numbers. This just struck me as alarmingly Germanic in the way that the curriculum seemed to be built on the principle of the catalytic converter instead of having a topics course that would say topics in American literature,
mm-hmm.
We had three authors in 19th century American literature, or three authors in 20th, just people, in order to teach a course, had invented all these courses, hundreds of these darn things. Hmm. And it just seemed untidy to me. And so the department put into the hands of someone who has empty shelf space at home the curriculum. And, I'm not a pack rat. And we have topics in now.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if you teach something a few times and decide that it should be a course, why, okay, let's go through the whole drill. But that was my selfish reason for being chair. I wanted a topics course that I could teach whatever I wanted under without having to go through, you got to go through the curriculum committee. Then it goes to the department. It goes to the department committee. Then it goes to the college. Then it goes to the L&S curriculum committee. And it goes to the divisional committee. I said, I'm not doing that. I'm too old for that. So we need something that that I can teach what I want to on there. Something simple, straightforward. So that's what we did.
And was the proposal, did it face a lot of opposition, or did you build consensus?
Oh, that was something else that people liked. I went to the offices of those faculty members who were grumpy or didn't see that this was an improvement, and talked with them in their offices and built consensus. I'd forgotten about that, but I came out of that with a, you know, people say things about things you've done and you have no idea that you were doing them. But one of the things that was said was, you know, you built consensus. And so you avoided a lot of the strife that things like that can descend into.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something else that was, I think, led people to think I'd be a good chair. But I there were some faculty who voted against me on the basis that I didn't know anybody and didn't know anything. I'd just been there a few years. Charles Scott was one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who else. It was maybe Howard Weinbrot. But there were a few faculty who, I mean, most people are happy to have somebody else do it. You know, I mean, my feeling was that being chair was an honor because you were being trusted to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an insult because it was thought that you didn't have anything better to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's about right. I mean, everybody else goes about their business and continues their research and writing and teaching while you're in there writing memoranda. But that was in that. I'll tell you, I interviewed, I had lunch with Eric Rothstein, and I asked him about whether or not he thought being chair was a worthwhile thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he had found it worthwhile because there were things that he wanted to do. Eric had wanted to improve the collegial atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
He was the guy that gave us a refrigerator and a microwave and tried to set up lunches. And there were a number of things he did along that line in addition to other more other things geared toward hiring and whatnot. But I said to him, you know, I just imagine that as chair, I'm going to have to make up my mind about a lot of things. And I'm going to be in front of people a lot. And that there's going to be a lot of phone calls, and I hate the phone. And I will have to be hosting parties, and this is not something that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed to be that a lot of things would be asked of me that I had not yet asked of myself or done out of my own desire.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, you're absolutely right. He said, you will have to make up your mind about things. There will be decisions that you have to make that no one can make for you. The phone calls are endless. He said, I found myself, after 3 years, I was much better on the phone. I was much better in public meetings and social gatherings.
Mm-hmm.
He said, he actually found being chair an opportunity for personal growth. And that was the hook for me. I thought if I could develop as a person by being chair, then this might be worth doing. So I eventually agreed to it. In fact, I wrote a long letter to Joe explaining why I decided not to stand for chair. And eventually took it back.
Did you send it to Joe?
I never sent it to him. Yeah.
When were you elected chair the first time?
It was 92. So I was 92, 92. 93, 93, 94, 94, 95.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know how we're doing on the tape. It might be worthwhile to...
This concludes side one of tape 7.